Good morning. I call the Legacy Finance Committee to order and seeing a quorum is present. We'll begin. Well, welcome to the Legacy Committee. I believe that this work that we do here is the most essential work that we do here at the Capitol. That's from a gentleman who wasn't a big supporter of the Legacy Amendment in 2008 to begin with. But I has observed the last 14 years that without clean water, life will end. And therefore, the work we do here for clean water for our districts, and I'm talking about the drinking water, all the other elements is important too, but none so more important than clean water. So if you get a little kibitzing from your legislators that the Legacy Committee only disperses $1 billion funds for frivolous things, they are wrong. So I am proud to be the chair, to co-chair in 5 weeks, maybe, maybe not, good Lord willing, who knows, this Legacy Committee. And I'd like to particularly welcome one of my favorite fellas here, Representative Lilly, who's coming in late. Let that be duly noted. And since he's sitting down, I also want to thank him for the pin, the Legacy Clean Water pin, that he gave me last week in session, and I wear it proudly. So thank you, Representative Lilly. With that, we're going to begin with introductions. And in your introductions, I want you to, if you would be so kind, to point out your favorite part of Legacy. You got your Outdoor Heritage Fund, your Arts and Culture Fund, Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund. And am I missing anything else? I think that's four, right?
Yeah.
And you can point out your favorite or not, but be bold and you could share that with us. So with that in mind, I think I want to start with our co-chair, future or maybe not, we don't know yet, co-chair Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be here and to be the DFL lead for Legacy, at least for now. I'm Representative Vang. I represent Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park area. This is my second time on the Legacy Committee, but I've always heard a lot of great things about it. And we get to talk about lots of fun stuff that not a lot of people get to in other committees. So very happy to be here. My favorite part of Legacy in within those four categories, I would have to say perhaps the Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. I think those are where we get to see where a lot of good projects, fun projects come from, and do what we got to do to support the community. So thank you.
Very good. Well, just without me interrupting, let's just go down the line here. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess probably my favorite is our staff. We've through the years, we've been really blessed with really good staff on this committee, and I just want to give them and the people that have received the funds through the years, I think have really been great. For me, it's probably Parks and Trails. Still is. I was out on my mountain bike last night and in the cold and just enjoying that. So, anyways.
Representative, before you begin, I left out the fifth one, which is Environmental and Natural Resources.
Thank you, Chair. State Representative Ethan Shaw from Woodbury. And my favorite part is going to be arts, culture, and heritage, you know. As an indigenous group from China and being a refugee, you know, the preservation of my culture and heritage is very important to me. So thank you.
Good morning. My name is Representative Huldah Hiltzley, representing the best district in the whole entire state of Minnesota. Okay, just putting it out there. I represent Brooklyn Park and Osseo. And favorite part, and I look forward to learning more, is the arts and culture because I've seen the work that it has done over the years. And so I'm looking forward to being a part of that. Thank you.
Representative Samaka Hussein from St. Paul, Senate District 665. Welcome. Part of my district. And it was fun being a legacy for the last 2 years in clean water, parks, and arts. And it's a fun committee to be with, and looking forward for us to work together again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. This is my third term serving on this committee. I was not on last by any means because it conflicted with my scheduling, but I love everything about this committee. Parks and Trails, Environment, Clean Water, Arts and Cultural, and looking forward to serving with all of you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bjorn Olson. I come from Fairmont, Minnesota. I represent just about everything south of Mankato to the Iowa border. One thing that almost 13 years in the United States Army has taught me is that I hate camping. And so my favorite aspect of the legacy is definitely the arts and cultural heritage portion of it. And Amy's giving me a scowl because she doesn't like that. But you try and stay in a tent for 2 weeks straight every single year. It's not fun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative John Burkle from the very flip side of the state, everything north of Thief River Falls, District 1A, up to the Canadian border. Been on Lessard Sams now the last 2 years, and I would say, you know, that's been a rewarding part of learning restoration and enhancement of riverbanks and streams and trying to balance that with private landowner needs in my district. So that's probably my favorite part of legacy. Thanks.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom DePell. I represent Cottage Grove, Hastings, Nininger, and Denmark Townships. Grew up on the Mississippi River. Clean water is absolutely critical, both our water resources and our groundwater. Unfortunately, Hastings is faced with a very serious issue right now with their drinking water, and I look forward to helping them through this committee and appreciate your support in that process.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Brainerd Lakes area is home, and this is hard to narrow it down, but good question. I think you're going to have a theme between Representative Scraba and I that parks and trails is something that's very prominent in our districts. I, in fact, have just a hop, skip, and a jump just nearby. Cuyuna, which many people know well if they've had a opportunity to hop on a mountain bike there, they would probably be addicted like my family is. So that is my favorite fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heinzman is correct. My name is Roger Scraba. I represent District 3A. I'm from Ely, Minnesota. You could say that northern Minnesota, everything north of Virginia and east of Grand Rapids, up, that's the district I represent. 11,700 square miles, some of it wilderness, but a lot of it are parks and trails. And it's important, you know, you want to go hiking on the North Shore Trail, you want to go biking on the Gitchigami, Mesabi, the Red Ball, I think it's Red Ball, I can't remember, the new one, but we are all about trails and parks, and it's something I look forward to supporting. It's just something my whole career as a mayor, everything is trails, trails, trails. I have a bike. I have a snowmobile. I don't have an ATV, but I support ATVs. Any trail, I'll support. Just bring it to us in a good manner, and I can help support trails. Thank you.
Very good. Joe McDonald from Wright County and part of Meeker County and a little bit of Hennepin County. So I go into the city just a bit, but most of my district is, I would consider it rural, and a lot of farmland, a lot of hunting land and fishing. I've been in here in the legislature now. This is going into my 15th year. So I beat my father, KJ McDonald, who was here for 14 years, now by 1 year. God save us. But it's a pleasure to be here, and I would say that my favorite part of legacy would be all components. They're all equally important. So, but I do have a trivia question after the staff or nonpartisan staff introduces themselves and tells their favorite part of legacy. And we'll start over here. Yes.
Sure. I'm Brad Hagemar at the House Fiscal Analysis Department. I would say my favorite part is that there's no base budget for each of these, so it's a little different than the rest of the budget. Good.
Janelle Taylor with House Research. I cover the three natural resource-related funds, and if I had to pick one of them, I would pick the Parks and Trails Fund.
Chair and members, Mary Davis from the House Research Department, and I cover the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and I was keeping score, so I do remember who loves that fund.
Hi, I'm Amy Zipko. I'm the committee administrator. I think I'll pick parks and trails. I think Minnesota has a really remarkable park and trail system.
Karina Nelson, the CLA. I am honestly brand new to the Legacy Finance Committee, so I'm looking forward to deciding which of the funds is my favorite.
Very good.
Chair and members, Mike Molzon, the committee administrator for Co-Chair Vang, and I'm especially partial to our great parks and trails system.
Very good. And over here to the left of us, yes. Very good, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm J.R. Swanson. I'm a public researcher, and I'll second what Representative Scott said. I'm a team creative, so I would say parks and trails.
Very good. Did we forget anyone?
Our pages.
Yes, pages. Would you please come forward and introduce yourselves? Stand right in front of everybody and the camera, please.
How's it going, representatives? Good to be here. My name is Eric Overstar. I'll be one of the House pages for the committee. And I'll say I'm excited to learn more about the Arts and Culture Fund.
I'm Sarah Johnson. I'm the third page. And I would say the trails are they're good for birdwatching.
Very good. Thank you very much. Well, we all know that this committee would not survive or be successful whatsoever without our staff, our nonpartisan staff, our partisan staff, and our pages, and our LAs and CAs. So for that, we are very grateful, and thank you for the work that you're going to do and the work that you're doing already. With that, then, we're going to, before we bring up our clean water presentation, folks, since Parks and Trails got 11 votes and Arts and Culture got 6 votes. The trivia question is for the Arts and Culture. There's a painting here to my right behind us of a gentleman who served here. No, wait, I won't say what it is. So the first one that can identify who this gentleman is and why there's a painting in this Capitol building of him gets a $2 bill. Anyone? In the audience? You know, Josh?
No, I'm pretty sure you're going to keep it $2.
Yes, I am. Anyone?
Got a hand over there.
The portrait of Senator Gordon Rosenmeyer, who served in the Senate from about 1940 to about 1970. He served from Little Falls area, Orson County. And he was a real student of the process of the legislature and how it worked, and he really wanted to improve it. So you think about that period of time, 1940 to 1970, a lot of changes happened in the state in general and in the legislative process.
Very good. Very impressive. Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair. He wasn't quite right. It was 1941 to 1971. So you earn a dollar.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out that he's a professional historian. This is his job, and he's already being paid to know who that guy is.
Duly noted. Duly noted. Yes, thank you. Yes, I agree. Yes, he was a great senator and was responsible for starting the Met Council, of course, from Little Falls, and also the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Council. So, very influential. So, and we give homage to Gordon Rosenmeyer. With that, we have our Clean Water Fund, one of the most important elements. Not the most, but one of the most, because they're all important, right? And we have Paul Gardner is with us. He's the administrator for Clean Water Council. And is John Barton here as well?
John Barton from Delano.
Yes, from my
my
good friend.
Trouble today, and couldn't make it here.
You couldn't make it. Okay.
Give me some instructions.
Very good. Well, for the record, would you introduce yourself, and you can begin your presentation.
Very good, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Minnesota Clean Water Council. I am a state employee, so they had to put me somewhere in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So I also have legions of help in the wings here in case people have questions from multiple agencies here. And fortunately, I'm not nervous enough to forget my password, so here we go. These are much plusher digs, too, Mr. Chair, than you had before in this committee. So, Mr. Chair, again, my name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Minnesota Clean Water Council. Chair John Barton, who is our Lakes and Streams nonprofits member and who's the chair of the council, couldn't make it today. He's from Delano, wasn't feeling well today. But he did want me to express his thanks for your consideration of the council's recommendations for the next 2 years in fiscal 26 and 27. We had a more thorough vetting process over the last year for these recommendations than we probably ever have had. We had tons of written questions and answers from agencies and the university. We had stakeholders by many dozens who gave their input to the what we put together even before we even knew what we were going to recommend. And that has been really helpful to have many of the members of the public chime in about clean water. Mr. Chair, I clocked this out at 20 minutes, but I know that if you have questions, you guys will just stop me, and it's your committee, so you can cut me off or speed me up, whatever you'd like to do. Okay, there we go. Members may not know, the Clean Water Council was created in 2006 as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act. At that time, we were facing several years of lawsuits, particularly from local governments, over the need for more funding for monitoring so that permits for municipalities could have the most accurate information for cost-effective permitting for reducing things like phosphorus. And we also had requirements from the US EPA for completing reports on total maximum daily loads, which is probably more than you want to know or in terms of acronyms. But the Clean Water Council was one of the things that was created as part of that effort to address those issues. We have the duty of submitting how to use the Clean Water Fund by January 15th of the odd-numbered year. We have 28 members on the council. 17 of them by statute can vote that represent particular constituencies such as environmental groups, farm organizations, local governments, and the like. And then we have 11 non-voting members who come from state agencies, 6 state agencies, the university, and 4 members from the legislature, 2 from the House from each caucus and 2 from the Senate from each caucus. Representative Heintzman, we will miss you on the Clean Water Council. You've got bigger fish to fry, as it were, as a committee chair. We're now going to have Representative Jacob, who's just been appointed from the House GOP caucus, and I believe Representative Purcell will be reappointed from the DFL caucus. You're familiar with the ratification of the Clean Water Fund in 2008. We have the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment logo here. We did a little stub that says your Clean Water Fund's at work. We have discovered that there's been a lot of confusion when the logo is used on something that looks kind of environment-y, and it's not clear to people whether it's from the Parks and Trails Fund or the After Heritage Fund or the Clean Water Fund. So we're starting to introduce that logo with the clean water stub. In 2009, after the ratification of the amendment, the council was given the responsibility of recommending how to use the Clean Water Fund. I did not do exact math to account for inflation, but roughly $3 billion will be used over 25 years of the amendment for clean water. So that sales tax would blink off June 30th at midnight on 2034. The constitutional language is fairly specific about where our lane is in the water universe, and that is to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in our surface waters, to protect groundwater, and to protect drinking water sources. We occasionally do have a robust debate, sometimes with legislative staff and legislators, about constitutional interpretations. Those are healthy discussions, and we usually find some resolution. We also have to spend at least 5% of the fund on drinking water source protection. And even a rudimentary calculation shows that we exceed that by several times. state statute in 2009 further narrowed some allowable uses of the fund. I won't read through all of those, but the important part is that we are not supposed to supplant existing funding for water, that we're supposed to supplement. We do always get the question about wastewater. We can support some wastewater treatment, but our lane has been really the point source implementation grant program at the Public Facilities Authority, which helps existing wastewater plants get within their permits for certain effluent like phosphorus. I was kind of hoping everyone would say clean water would be their favorite by the end of this presentation. I'm not sure how that's going just yet. there are seven agencies that are the initial recipients of the funding, as well as the University of Minnesota. So when you do get the legacy bill language, that's what you'll see. However, about two-thirds of that money leaves the state to support grants, loans, easements, and other technical assistance that's provided direct to landowners, local units of government, and other entities that are actually implementing clean water. Soil and water conservation districts in particular are a key partner for us. And of all the FTEs that are supported by the Clean Water Fund, more than half of them are in Greater Minnesota, where most but not all are in direct contact with people throughout the state to help get clean water. One of the biggest complaints that most legislators and even members of the Clean Water Council have when they first see the legacy bill itself is that it's a long list of programs with a lot of similar words like watershed and protection and restoration. And they'll say, tell them that we can't quite figure out how this all fits together. So we have worked together this little 30-second elevator speech to explain the general gist of it, which is we test our waters when it comes to surface waters to figure out if there's anything wrong. If there is anything wrong, we want to find the source of the problem. When we find the source, we come up with a plan to fix the problem. We work with local stakeholders to figure out which of the problems to solve first, and then we fund the fixes that get us to cleaner water. That is a process that can take a decade or more, usually. Once in a while, there are projects that help, just a one-off will help us get to where we need to go on a particular project. But for the most part, we're dealing with non-point source pollution. 85% of our impaired waters are due to non-point sources. So these are minute bits of contaminants like sediment, nitrogen, phosphorus, and the like, bacteria, which accumulated over an entire watershed, get you a bad result. We call this whole process the water management framework, but I'm going to spare you from using government lingo because that's when people's eyes glaze over, but you can see it in the parentheses as well for the various steps. Legislators also tell me that a picture says 1,000 words. People like maps and pictures, and I think this illustrates how we go about things for surface waters very well. This is the Yellow Medicine River watershed in that feeds into the Minnesota River. You can see Montevideo and Granite Falls there along the river, which runs from about 11 o'clock to 4 o'clock on the map. This is one of 80 major watersheds in the state that we look at. They have an average of about 700,000 acres in them, so that's the scale we're trying to manage. The red lines indicate impaired waters. These waters do not meet water quality standards for at least one out of 31 different measures. It's a bit like a pass-fail test, except you only pass if you get all 31 questions right. It's not much of a choice. So we can have waters that are barely impaired for one thing. It could be heavily impaired for multiple things. It just depends. So the red lines are impaired waters impaired streams. The red dots are impaired lakes. The dark blue are ones that are considered healthier. On the upper right, you can see the type of pollutant that we're dealing with here. I'm not trying to pick on this district in particular. It's just that the map worked. But this is an agricultural area with a lot of drain tile, and you'll see lots of agricultural-related things like bacteria and sediment and nutrients in there. That's a problem. Now, this is a dull-looking table, but this is what the Clean Water Fund helps us figure out, which is if you do a certain number of projects in a watershed that we have in the summary table and do them by a certain date, you should get the desired water quality results, and we actually have an idea of what it will cost to do it. That is an extremely powerful data set, and we usually project out 10 years. So we have an idea in all these watershed plans what we're going to do and what it's going to cost for the next 10 years and what outcomes we're going to get. What that means in the Yellow Medicine River is that we have lots of green triangles. I know that doesn't make a lot of sense, but there's a correlation between where we're spending money from the Clean Water Fund on what we call implementation funding, where the problem is. So we're not doing this in a random sense. We're actually targeting resources where we know the problem is and where we'll have the greatest likelihood of success. I should point out that the plan to finish this was done in 2017. The initial monitoring was started in 2010, and now we're monitoring to see whether this works. So this is a lengthy scale. My agency colleagues talk about how we play the long game here. That's why the 25 years of the amendment is so important, so we can do planning over multiple years. For drinking water and groundwater, our logical process is very similar. I use Verndale here in Wadena County as an example because the map looks illustrates things very well. The municipal boundary is the gold line for the city of Verndale. Highway 10 runs through the district, and there are two wellheads alongside there. The groundwater moves to the north-northeast, and so anything that's in that blue area can contaminate the well at some point soon. The problem is that it extends beyond municipal boundaries, and so the city doesn't have a lot of control over protecting their drinking water supply for the land outside. So using the Clean Water Fund, the health department, and the local water utility work together to create what one of Representative Heinzman's favorite acronyms, the DWISMA, the Drinking Water Supply Management Area. There are more than 900 of these around the state. Within that DWISMA, then agencies work together with the utility and landowners to figure out the most mutually beneficial arrangements so we can reduce the potential flow of contaminants like too much nitrate or manure into a well sometime within the next 10 years. That data is really powerful, and then we also support grants for half of the requests that municipality has to fix the problem. That could be cover crops for the area outside the town for the farmer to figure out how they can still make money and protect water quality. It can include removing old fuel storage tanks, educating residents and businesses about spills and the like. And we're almost all done in coming up with the plans for all 900 plus of these. In terms of geographic distribution, I can't tell you how long it took to get this map put together, but this lists three of our largest programs at the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We have projects that cover the entire state, including the metro with a heavy density of work there. The one area where you see a lot of white spaces are public lands that are state and national forests in northern Minnesota, although you will see this ribbon of dots there for towns on the Iron Range, for example, where there's drinking water supply management area work. And, of course, Ely is in there, Representative Scraba. There you go. We actually do spend a lot of money to help do things like seal old wells in your neck of the woods and septic system inspection. We were asked in statute last year under Chair Emeritus Lilly look at how our work is addressing inequities in access to clean water. And we have noted that you can have disparities in access to clean water because of where you live and what your income is. It doesn't matter whether you live in the core cities or the suburbs or greater Minnesota. If you are unable, for example, to afford a water treatment system, you may not have access to clean water, as an example. But I have a couple of examples of where we are doing things to give people equal opportunity for clean water. So in concert with bonding, of course, which is the biggest source, we also help support affordable water and sewer bills in a lot of small towns in greater Minnesota. We've helped a lot of communities, some unincorporated, that are under-sewered or unsewered, get a plan together for what they need to do to ask for money from the legislature, for the Public Facilities Authority, for a bigger solution or federal money. We've helped about three dozen communities do that. We've made new appropriations for tribal governments as well as non-governmental organizations, 501c3s. So we just had a grant round close for the second time to find new ideas that aren't just the usual suspects in government coming up with solutions. We want to look for new ideas wherever they may be. Our state agencies are required to consult with our tribal governments wherever issues affect them. And while we don't generally have a consultative relationship with the tribes, the agencies we fund do. We've also worked with the Met Council, helping some low-income communities deal with leaks and more efficient fixtures using the Clean Water Fund. Low-income households can qualify for a grant to replace septic systems. This has helped in not just the seven-county metro area, but greater Minnesota. Not all counties participate, but sometimes it's more expensive to replace a septic system than the value of the property itself. And in many cases, it may just it's faster to solve the problem with a grant. We also have a new program to provide free well testing for nitrates for every private well user in the state over the course of 10 years. And we're focusing on nitrates in southeastern Minnesota to begin with. We do have a policy platform. That is in the last couple of pages of the abridged version of the recommendations that you have in your packet. The council acknowledges that the Clean Water Fund isn't going to solve everything. We have some policy statements that assemble things that in some cases we are doing already but has never been recorded in one place. This is one of our coordinating roles as the council to pool together the efforts of all the agencies simultaneously. In the drinking water source protection area, we have a new statement that encapsulates what the state is either required to do or is choosing to do with our support and has been really helpful. We've also touched the third rail of drainage. We were told that that was a very difficult thing to work on, but we have engaged with the drainage work group to let them know that when ditches are being upgraded and we have 20,000 miles of ditches, that it's an opportunity to work with landowners to find to bring some technical expertise and some grants to help them keep the benefits of drainage but also store some water temporarily in the area so that we can improve water quality. So it's a win-win for everybody. And almost done here, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to list some highlights. These are from the executive summary, the one-pager in your packet. Almost all watersheds in the state now have that comprehensive plan that I described in my elevator speech. The deal is that when they finish the plan, they get additional money. So we are seeing an increased outlay to watersheds to fulfill those plans. We're also boosting support for continuous living cover through the programs like Forever Green, which I'm sure you're familiar with from the Ag Committee, for those of you on that committee, as well as soil health grants. We've got increased support for private well users that I mentioned. We're a little fuzzy on what's going to happen on federal matching grants here, but we have made money available to soil and water conservation districts in the Lake Superior Basin so that they can add capacity to apply for federal money. To date, we have had to pass up opportunities to get some matching federal funds because folks in the local area did not have the capacity to seek those funds. I mentioned our policy statements, and then all of the watersheds in the state will finish those comprehensive plans by the end of this year, which will chart their progress for 10 years. And then I want to thank you for your attention. Could I tell my sob story about my favorite part of the legacy within 30 seconds?
Please do. You have plenty of time.
Oh, very good. Well, we always get twice as many questions as time needed. But this is Rice Creek in Shoreview. I live in Shoreview in Ramsey County. There are lots of Rice Creeks, but this is ours that feeds into the Mississippi River at Fridley. This area, roughly 100 years ago, was ditched. It was an agricultural area, so people wanted the benefits of drainage. But as the suburbs spread, this area, this is actually on public land, it became an area where we could restore the stream to its original course, slow down the water, provide some habitat and recreational opportunities. So we got the trifecta of parks, trails, habitat, and clean water. But the Clean Water Fund helped support the Rice Creek Watershed District to re-meander this creek in several sections. And now it's one of the most popular recreational assets around. My sob story is that when I started this job 6 years ago, my son was a senior in high school. And I asked him that summer what he would like to do with me together as the last thing before he went off into the world. And he said, let's go kayaking down Rice Creek because that's what we do together. And just gets you a little, he's long gone now. that was what the legacy amendment means to me. It's a legacy in our backyard. As you saw from all the dots, there's something somewhere in your backyards that is supported by legacy. Even though we have tons of data, it's not always easy to pull together things at my fingertips with some master map. But if you are interested in everything going on in your district, I'd be happy to pool that information together and let you know, and you can share that with whoever you like. So, Mr. Chair, that is all I got for now. I usually find that people have lots of intriguing questions, and then we have some experts who can answer specifics if I can't answer.
Mr. Gardner, thank you. I'm sure we have some very intriguing questions. There's a great story. Thank you for sharing. I had the pleasure of meeting with you and Mr. Barton in Delano, who he's from Delano, so we met earlier last year to go over the Clean Water Council, so I appreciate the refresher for myself, and we know the important work that you and your team are doing. Any questions from our members? We have a question from the ever-capable Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. I have been visiting with a number of folks, and in fact, you and I have talked a little bit about this, which might be an impact that we need to brace for, and just, again, as we often do, put what might be a challenging circumstance on the radar. There could be, in our upcoming February forecast, a circumstance that might result in our friends at SWCDs looking for revenues. And I just wanted to check and see if that is a circumstance that the Clean Water Council could potentially be anticipating. It has historically been a source of funding for SWCDs, although not without controversy. I'm aware of that, and it's under, you know, what could be a challenging circumstance, as I mentioned. I hope not, but just wanting to make sure that that's on the radar.
Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman. I'm afraid we, in our contingency planning, we think of every disaster that could befall us, I think. But just for some context, when the buffer law was carried out under Governor Dayton, I think part of the arrangement in some way was that the Soil and Water Conservation Districts needed some additional money in order to be able to work with landowners to make that buffer law happen. And that created pressure for additional capacity funding for Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Initially, the legislature made an appropriation from the Clean Water Fund. It was not part of our recommendations, but as we're reminded, the legislature appropriates the money, and we are advisory, and that's just how it goes. And so that happened for several budget cycles where it was not in our recommendations, but money was found. In the last session, the tax bill has been used to provide soil and water conservation district capacity assistance, capacity aid, similar to LGA or county program aid. And that has been great. That has given them the flexibility to meet the needs of landowners in their area. If that were to revert back to the Clean Water Fund, if it's something that's been funded by the general fund now, my guess is that some might see that as supplanting. But, of course, the legislature has the final say. We certainly support our soil and water conservation districts. They are the boots on the ground that actually carry out programs, including here with several conservation districts in the metro. But we'll certainly keep an eye out. We are also concerned about where federal matching funding is going to go. There have been a lot of programs that seem to be halted, but everything changes by the hour, and we can't really know what's going to happen. So there might be some programs that are held up, but we still have state money to, you know, do the projects, but maybe we do half of the project, or maybe we have to wait longer. We're not really sure. So we're always on pins and needles for that February forecast, Representative Heinzman, and any other developments between now and the end of session.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, Director. I think we all agree, just as you stated, that soil and water conservation districts are the boots on the ground, creating that kind of scenery with their effort and the opportunity to enhance and clean up in many cases restoring that meandering stream that we're all enjoying a picture of today. But then there's also lots and lots of other examples, and it's a huge part of, I think, Minnesotans' priorities, and I'm glad that your good work there has helped soil and water conservation districts with project dollars, but this is something that is potentially on the horizon, and I hope that the forecast shows otherwise and funding is intact as it previously has been established. But I don't think any of us want soil and water conservation districts to be suffering due to a lack of dollars because of pressure on the general fund. So just wanting to quickly address that today. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. Important question and important comment from you. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. I'm from Woodbury, so I'm going to talk about PFAS, right? And so in the last year, we broke ground on our water treatment plant, which is going to cost the city about $400 million, and we're going to need a $14 million water tower to store that water. So can you touch on some of your PFAS, I guess, initiatives for the state of Minnesota?
Certainly. And
yes,
Chair, Representative Cha. So there is a lane for us with the Clean Water Fund with PFAS. The state has produced the PFAS blueprint, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which covers everything from product bans to water treatment to sampling for where else it might be. The three areas where we do fund things related to the PFAS response in that blueprint are as follows. One is with river and lake and groundwater monitoring, so we have programs to the MPCA to incorporate that in the intensive water monitoring that takes place all year round throughout the state so that we can see if it might be somewhere else. The second area is with the DNR. They have been testing fish for mercury and PCBs for years, and now they've added, with your generous support last year, added PFAS, so we can detect that on a wider scale. And then the third area is with the Department of Health's Contaminants of Emerging Concern program. That has been funded by the Clean Water Fund from the get-go, and the folks in their public health lab actually help determine health risk or health-based guidance, as well as health risk limits on a few occasions, including with PFAS compounds. They were overloaded with requests for different PFAS compounds because there are hundreds of them, as I understand it. And so they've been trying to review literature and to see just what the number should be to give help to people who drink water, what the acceptable amount is. But in terms of the infrastructure part, we have been told by nonpartisan staff in the Senate that to mitigate contaminated groundwater would not be consistent with the Constitution. We had made recommendations to try and support some modest efforts with nitrate water treatment for private well users, and we were told a strict reading of the constitutional amendment would not allow for mitigation. So once something is already contaminated, we can no longer protect it. And the constitutional amendment says we can only spend to protect. I can only pass on what we have learned from that. But we certainly have a multi-agency commitment with PFAS, and we have worked over the last 2 years to figure out where we can best contribute to that, and those are the three areas.
Representative Chong?
Yes, thank you very much for the answer. And then my second question is in regards to nitrate. You know, I sat on ag in the last two sessions, and we have this the issue of nitrate levels in southeast and western Minnesota. Can you also touch on that nitrate and what are we doing as a state to combat that?
Certainly.
Mr. Gardner.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cha. So we have a multifaceted response to nitrate. We're doing stuff to help people find nitrate to begin with, but then many community groups and environmental groups filed a petition with the EPA a year ago. Requesting some emergency action, and the result was EPA directed the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, and the MPCA to come up with a multifaceted response, which we're now carrying out in part with the Clean Water Fund. So our lane there has been to increase the amount of private well tests that are available for people in southeastern Minnesota. Not everybody chooses to test their water, but everyone's going to get the opportunity to do it. Then they're provided with some advice on what to do if they have nitrate levels that are too high. And then the mitigation part we cannot cover. The MPCA, not through the Clean Water Fund, but on their own, has been modifying the feedlot permit, which involves the land application of manure. So there are some tighter restrictions on when and how you can apply manure in certain places at certain times where the groundwater is vulnerable. And then Department of Ag and, of course, the Board of Water and Soil Resources have been working with landowners, those applying manure and commercial fertilizer, to help them figure out how they can improve water quality for surface waters as well as groundwater and drinking water, and also make some money at the same time. It turns out that most farmers who have made changes in their farming habits have usually reduced their input costs, including the application of fertilizer and manure, and their crops have been more resilient to too much water or not enough water with changing weather patterns, and that has been picking up. We would like it to be faster, but we have many, many opportunities to do that, and we have requests for those in the recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Representative Chaw, to continue.
Sorry, Chair, I have one more question.
You don't have to apologize.
We have a lot of time. You know, as we see, we're having a lot of water issues throughout the United States, especially in California and, you know, in Colorado with the water drying up. Can you give us a quick snapshot of the health of our access to water in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Gardner.
As a history major, Mr. Chair, I'll give the maybe a broadest description, but the DNR can certainly fill in on some details. Generally speaking, if you compare us to other states, we are water abundant. There are certain corners of the state, like in the far northeast and the southwest, where the bedrock is very close to the surface and there just is no place to get water. Fairmont is the one area I was thinking of where in points west where it's just hard to store water in the ground. We obviously are interested in the protection of the Mississippi River. We have a strategy to protect several hundred thousand acres of land that if we do that, through a variety of funding sources, we can protect high-quality water in the upper Mississippi headwaters indefinitely. When it comes to PFAS, I've mentioned that, and nitrates. Are you talking about availability?
Yes.
You know, there are spots in the state where water may be hard to come by, but we also have groundwater mapping that's been going on for some time. The Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund and the Clean Water Fund help support the county geologic atlases. Those will be done in about another 8 years or so. And then groundwater atlases are done after that, where we can actually determine the behavior of the aquifers and not only which way they're going, but volumes and where the constraining geologic layers are. And there's even some watersheds where there's the University of Minnesota's geological survey is doing three-dimensional mapping. So we have more capabilities than our peers in other states. Vigilance is really our key tool here. We're not Arizona or California, fortunately, where it rains once, you know, a couple times a year, or in a monsoon, things are more critical. But we have seen very wet years interspersed with very dry years, and that's causing some whiplash, occasionally well interference from irrigation in dry years that the DNR can deal with using the permit authority they have. So, there's a whole range of things. We have a couple of pages in the full recommendations online that describe what we're doing on groundwater generally. And I always should, the Met Council will be mad if I don't mention that we do spend some money to help people, including in Woodbury, which has done very well, to reduce excessive water use in irrigation. I think they're reducing water in Woodbury by something like 20 or 25,000 gallons per household when they help get better irrigation controllers, which are sometimes supported by the Met Council through the Clean Water Fund. So.
Representative Chaw, anything else?
I hope I've pandered enough there.
No, thank you very much for the response, and thank you, Chair.
Thank you. A very important question, PFAS. My son, Aiden, who's 19, is very into health, food, and science, and he's been warning me for years not to use metal on our Teflon plates and pans, and very important. I get it now. after being on Clean Water or the Legacy, do not use metal on Teflon or be a Teflon that, at all to be cooking your food, right, Representative Heisman? So thank you for the question. Yes, we have Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gardner. Thanks to the Clean Water Council and to you for, I understand there's a possible transition in your role in the future, and congratulations, but thank you for all your work that you've done in this in that role. So for we have a few new members, so it's interesting, might be interesting for them to go back to the data, was so important that we established data on all these watersheds, and maybe you could speak a little more to that. I think it's important for people to know, because for years before Legacy, we really didn't have that data, and so you've been able to get that, and then that became a frustration for some of us, as you know. Then let's get to work, right? So, and now you're very much into the work phase. But if you could just quickly speak to the data and how that came about, and now that you have that, you had that nice chart. But if you could just give it a couple more thoughts,
Mr. Gardner,
that'd be helpful.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, so an initial focus with the Clean Water Fund was to do monitoring around the state. When it came to surface water quality, the way it was put to me is that we were pretty much responding to complaints if we needed to look for something. We didn't have an idea of which waters were healthy and which ones were not and to what degree. Today we have what some people call a world-class monitoring system. I'll take them at their word, so that we actually can diagnose problems a little more thoroughly. I compare it to a little bit like doing a physical at the Mayo Clinic as opposed to getting your vital signs checked at your local general practitioner, where you get a more comprehensive look at everything from the geology and the groundwater to soil types, slope, the history of the land, and the like. I think sometimes we have given people the impression that we keep increasing monitoring, but all of the science, not just the monitoring, but the fish and the like, has only taken up about 15% of the fund throughout the whole length of the fund. One of my counterparts, Mr. Johnson, at the Outdoor Heritage Council, said we were lucky because we actually had monitoring data to see if the fix worked. So we actually can look years down the road to see if the restoration and protection strategies we're using were actually working. So that's something that other states don't have, and they get all upset when we go to conferences because they can't do what we can do. So our problem right now, if it's a problem, is that we have information about outcomes also, but to the average person, it is kind of not very accessible, and it's in a lot of different places. So we're trying to figure out how we can best visualize the data that we have to show how things are working, like having a dial that says we're 70% of the way there, or we're using, instead of talking about parts per million and percent risks and standard deviations and that sort of thing, we could have something that the average person could understand. So that's actually our mission for the next couple of months on the council, is to work with the agencies to figure out how we can pool this information together in something that makes some sense. I do want to mention we have a new story map on our website. If you Google Minnesota Clean Water Council, there's a nifty story map that's sort of animated that helps explain my little elevator speech, but with shows particular projects that we use, and we really needed something to explain at the average person level what our strategy is. So,
Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it'd be good for members to look at, read some of the Bowser articles that they've done, and how they work with farmers, and how the, these progress and work with people. And I think one of our representatives is a Perry, or I'm not sure who, but I think is a certified farmer.
Several.
Okay. Did Hanson make the cut or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I'm not sure, but I data privacy rules in statute. For people who have said that it's okay to share, I know that Representative Paul Anderson and Representative Jacobs.
Farmers. Okay. Yep. Thank you. So then,
very good. Thank you, Representative Lilly, for that important issue as well. Do you have one more thing?
I do.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, that's all right.
No, don't apologize.
So I think it'd be good for members, too, because there's a couple of us that are lucky enough to be on Lessard Sam. So Representative Heitzman and Burkle and myself, I'm looking around. But, you know, the thing that goes on that I think it'd be good to speak to as far as for these other members to know about is how you kind of work together on big projects. And then I thought your Rice Creek example was perfect because I think as a committee, here's my bias, but I think our goal is to try to figure out how to have each fund, you know, to work together and have synergy together. And there's some great examples between you and Lessard Sam's where, you know, you'll do a certain component of a project and then they'll do parts. So if you can kind of speak to that and just help help us all learn more about how that's happening.
Mr. Gardner.
There's two questions there. One is... And Representative Lilly, I do appreciate how you've said that data is good, but telling a story is just as good. It depends on the audience. And so we have lots of good stories to tell. And the Bowser's snapshots are good. We have a monthly newsletter. If you go to our website, you can sign up for that. And every 2 weeks, we list stories of what's going on. I have had agencies tell me that before the Clean Water Fund, sometimes it felt like they were acting in silos and doing their own thing. After the Clean Water Fund, with dollars available to do big, complex projects that make a difference, it required people to work together. And not just at the state level, but also with state entities and landowners. We can't get to clean water without private landowners buying into the system. So the funding has allowed people to work together in a seamless fashion. You asked me the second question about
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have examples of how you've worked with Lessard Sam's, and maybe you can speak to that,
Mr. Gardner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly. So there is a phrase we use: multiple benefits. In the statute, it says that we ought to fund things that have multiple benefits, not just clean water, but it could be a clean water project that helps habitat or adds a recreational asset or something, or helps economic development, like making sure a small community has a functioning sewer system. And then it works the other way. So there are Lessard Sam's projects that are good for habitat, which also are good for water quality or recreation.
Right.
The important part is that we fund the thing where the clean water is the main reason for something. But there are times when we have a complex project where you have a piece of land where, boy, it's a great opportunity to have some habitat while we're doing this clean water thing. So the St. Louis River Area of Concern is an example where we funded the MPCA staff to help planning, to get bonding funding to help clean up the St. Louis River estuary. But the Outdoor Heritage Fund was used to do, I believe it was wild rice plantings in that area as well. So our local managers and some of the state agency staff that help put these complex projects together are very skilled at knowing which pot to ask for. And certainly the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund has been another source for things that help water. So we can never say that only the Clean Water Fund is the only way to get to clean water. We have a variety of sources, as well as federal money, local contributions, and landowner contributions. We don't even really count that in our calculations. So if a farmer decides to do a project where they can get a grant from either the Clean Water Fund or federal money, they're still putting a lot of their own money in with their own skin in the game, too. But we don't always count that. So,
Representative Lilly?
That's basically it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then thank you, Mr. Gardner. But one final thing. So, would you say our water is more swimmable, fishable, and drinkable at this point than we were before Legacy?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, most definitely. We have three accessible words: swimmable, fishable, and drinkable. Swimmable and fishable have some proxy measurements that are mentioned deep in the bowels of our report, if you care to look. But we have increased the number of swimmable waters by, I can't tell you the exact number, but that's usually measured by clarity or a water quality standard for aquatic recreation. And then fishable is aquatic life impairments, I think. We have slightly less fishable waters than swimmable waters, and we're moving very nicely beyond expectations on swimmable waters, but fishable waters have been harder. We also have added new impairments since the Clean Water Fund started. So it's a little bit like moving the goalposts where we think we're getting somewhere and then, oh boy, there's this new contaminant we have to account for. And then, so that adds some stuff. So PFAS is an example. We weren't listing PFAS impairments in 2008, I don't think. Now we do, so our numbers get bigger.
Very good. Our next question comes from Representative Hussein.
Commissioner, thank you for putting this wonderful PowerPoint together. My question is there any top priority for Clearwater proposed this year that we can work with you on that one? And is there any, what are the top legislator priority for the Clean Water Council in this coming up session? And are there any policy changes being proposed to enhance water conservation offer or to address the climate-related water challenge that we've seen in the globally?
Mr. Gardner.
In the state of Minnesota as well.
Mr. Chair, as some people know, I was a member of the House many years ago, and I remember someone telling me that when everything's a priority, nothing's a priority, and usually when they didn't like something we were proposing. but in this case, we're trying to manage water on multiple fronts. So we're trying to address drinking water and surface water and groundwater simultaneously in every corner of the state. And sometimes that makes it harder to give you a straight answer sometimes about how things are going, because we're trying to manage so many different things. You will be receiving a jacket, some jackets for the Parks and Trails and Clean Water Funds together very soon. I'm not exactly sure where that's coming, so we'd love to have the support of the legislature for the council's recommendations. We have several, you asked about policy, we have several policy recommendations. There are we're always reminded again by the legislature that they make the policy and we don't, but we can advise. And there are some areas in the drinking water policy statement where there are some things above and beyond what we're doing that we're suggesting. We know that there will be funding needed for mitigation strategies, meaning to help communities get clean water, whether it's in Hastings or Woodbury or private wells in greater Minnesota. So we know that we can't meet all of those things. I hope I got sort of where you were looking for, Representative Hussein.
Representative Hussein?
I just need one follow-up question. What program exists to help cities like St. Paul improve stormwater management and reduce the pollution from urban runoff?
Mr. Gardner.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hussein, so several things. Well, first, a city like St. Paul does have to have a what's called an MS4 permit, a stormwater permit. So there are certain things they must do under the Clean Water Act. But there are things the Clean Water Fund does to help enhance that. So we have grants used by, like, the Capital Region Watershed District in St. Paul or the Ramsey-Washington Metro Watershed District. I sort of know where your district is in the east, or from Snelling to 35E, I think, north of 94. We have helped cities that have a very small footprint where you can't do a lot of bulldozing to start over to help install stormwater filtration systems so that water can settle out. The biggest one I can think of in St. Paul is the Highland Bridge development on the old Ford Motor Company site. There's a lot of money being invested there, but $7 million of that came from the Clean Water Fund through the Public Facilities Authority to help all the water coming from that Highland Park neighborhood settle out in an underground chamber so that the water coming into the stream that's in that chiseled limestone creek there is considerably cleaner. And when you go down to Hidden Falls Park where it flows under the road, there's another storm drain coming from the rest of the neighborhood that isn't treated, and it stinks. So it shows the value of that those settlement things. There are daylighting projects. Trout Brook Reserve in I believe in your district is an area where the railroad put a creek into culvert so they could build an industrial facility there for 100 years. And that's gone, and so the Watershed District with the Clean Water Fund helped daylight the stream, took out the culvert, created a park out of it, and Senator Hurd tells me he bikes in there regularly, and that is helping improve water that's going into the Mississippi River. Como Lake has multiple projects, and this is true in other core cities in the metro and throughout greater Minnesota, multiple projects from reducing runoff from the golf courses to from the parking lots, and they're just almost there at Como Lake and meeting the getting off the impaired waters list for phosphorus. So the Capital Region Watershed District loves the Clean Water Fund. They do lots of stuff in St. Paul.
Thank you. I appreciate
Representative Hussein.
I just have one more question that's coming from my constituents. How does the Clean Water Council engage local community, particularly low-income communities and PIPACs?
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Gardner.
Representative Hussein, thank you for bringing that up. So we are starting to develop a better public engagement strategy. For years, we have received public input from the people who show up. And as you know, in the Capitol, you know, there are people who are paid to show up and interest groups. And I remember former Chair Ann Lincheski used to say, I'll take public testimony from the people who aren't paid to be here first, and then everybody else after that. We're a little bit like that, where we have people who give us input on where we're going, but we have not had a good strategy for how to reach out to the people who aren't paid to be there and to have a more proactive public engagement strategy. We have some new members who are really pushing us on the Clean Water Council to do this. We have done better with the tribes, I would say, because there's an intergovernmental relationship there. But we would love to talk to any community groups in your area, in any of your areas in the state, on how we can get your ideas before we start to make the next set of recommendations. Because 2025 is our time to do a deep dive and figure out what is on people's minds.
Representative Hussein, anything else? Okay, we have Representative Vang, and then on deck is Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gardner, for your presentation. Perhaps can you give us a refresher on what's the Clean Waters Council's process of making these recommendations? Like, do these agencies submit requests to you guys to sort through? And if the demand is higher than what we can fund, if that's usually the case?
Good question, Representative Vang. Mr. Gardner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Vang. Yes, so it takes almost a year to get through our process. It can seem kind of slow, but it's very thorough. And, of course, your budget-making process is much more condensed and intense. So usually about February of the even-numbered year, which would be next February, we start hearing proposals. We usually hear it from state agencies and the university, but we do hear from others occasionally on some specific projects. We do hear from stakeholders in the odd-numbered year, so this is the year where we want to hear from people on ideas before we start baking the cake, which is why the public engagement strategy will be good. We really want to send agencies priorities from the council through our strategic plan now, between now and the end of this year. We have had agencies have purposely not sent us a proposal on something because of input they've received from us. But they always the requests have always been higher than the money available. And so the council has often set priorities for certain things. So Forever Green, which I know you're very familiar with, has gotten a boost in funding in recent years because we realize that's a very important long-term play for water quality. It can help us with sustainable aviation fuel, which we could be a hub for here in Minnesota, and help farmers make more money. So drinking water in southeastern Minnesota has also been a priority. We are starting to ask the question of what happens between now and 2034. I can't really talk about what happens after that. That's not appropriate for me as a state employee, but there are some cases where we're starting to ask the question, what do we absolutely have to do beyond that and find funds for if there isn't anything afterwards, and what things can be nice but left behind. And we're in process. So,
Representative Vang? Very good. Representative Hilsley.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for being here. And I have four questions, so bear with me. I appreciate Representative Lilly for acknowledging the new members, as me being one of them, so bear with me here. So my first question for Mr. Gartner is, in your expert opinion, what are the biggest emerging threats in Minnesota's quality, water quality, and how is the council adapting to this, to its strategies to address them?
Mr. Gartner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilsley?
Hilsley, yes.
I'm glad you didn't ask them all together. Emerging threats are always there. There are threats that we were not evaluating in 2008 and 9 when the amendment started that we are looking at now. PFAS, of course, is on a much larger scale. I have multiple ways of answering that question. So we have something called contaminants of emerging concern. These are often contaminants that are being found in our water. They're nominated in a process to the Department of Health for evaluation. They go through a triage process to figure out which ones are, you know, five alarm fires. The PCA often, with things like pharmaceuticals, has looked at toxicity to fish on some of those things to figure out where we should focus attention. There are also things like microplastics, where we have a study that's still to come out about the presence of microplastics that Representative Hansen has been very interested in. Because of that monitoring network, we can find more things. And the more things you find, the more questions you have. Yeah. We also have things that I would call early warning systems also. So we have monitoring wells that the Department of Natural Resources has around the state. There's about 1,200 monitoring wells where they can look at things like water levels to see if there's anything that's a potential threat to, say, aquifers in a particular area where wells might dry up for people. We have ambient monitoring networks for the PCA where they look at water quality to see if there's anything unusual going on. So we have ways of detecting things that are coming in a way that other states do not have. They wait until the crisis hits. There are other things that lottery money is helping pay for, like looking at biosolids. That's something that's of concern because there can be PFAS in biosolids from the stuff we flush, pharmaceuticals. Those are emerging concerns where we're not really sure what the threat is yet, but that isn't necessarily in our bailiwick, but others are looking at it.
Awesome. All right, Representative, your second question.
Thank you, Chair. All right, I think you cut down my questions to two now instead of four. Three. So my next question is, how does the council ensure that Clean Water Fund protects, prioritizes communities that are most impacted by water contamination, such as rural areas and historically marginalized communities?
Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsley. Several of the agencies have tools that are available to us to help figure out where the disparities are. So, for example, the Pollution Control Agency has an environmental justice map that they revise regularly for three factors, and one of them is income, as well as a certain percentage of people of color and a certain percentage of households with an income below a certain level. They're not always sometimes they're together and sometimes they're mutually exclusive, but there are census tracts like that all over the state, urban, rural, suburban, that fit that. Those criteria are being used in some cases with some of our grants. So I was on a review panel for chloride reduction where we helped to figure out how to reduce chloride that's getting in our wastewater that can cause a problem. And environmental justice, you got a few extra points in. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was the submissions from Greater Minnesota that had the environmental justice census tracts in them. So I think it's sometimes counterintuitive. So we're starting to use that as a criteria for evaluation. I did mention, in the last few pages of our full recommendations, not the abridged version you have, we have information about our collaboration with the tribes and with 11 tribal governments, and also I just call it an equity assessment to see how we're doing. We know that we need to grow that a little bit, but there certainly is a recognition by all state agencies that some communities have borne the brunt of environmental pollution more than others. And so we want to make sure everybody has access to clean water, and we evaluate that in lots of different ways. So,
all right, Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you, Chair. Last one. So from our end, are there any areas where you see a need for legislative support to strengthen oversight or improve transparency in clean water fund spending? Thank you.
Mr. Gardner.
Perhaps I could ask you to ask that again to make sure I got it right.
Representative Hiltzley.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Are there any areas where you see a need for legislative support to strengthen oversight, or improve transparency in clean water fund spending?
Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hiltzley. I know that accountability and transparency is a hot topic this year, which is great. I can tell you that we measure things like crazy and evaluate effectiveness, particularly on the outcomes. So we have folks who model what the desired output will be or the outcome. We have computer modeling for example, if you're doing a stream restoration, to know with some reliability how many tons of sediment you'll avoid having go downstream and how many pounds of phosphorus that won't end up in the water. And then we're constantly, not me, and thank you for calling me an expert, I'm not an expert, but our state folks and our local partners use everything from LIDAR to something we call PTM app to help calculate what the impacts will be of the dollar spent. And we, it's annoyingly transparent if you dig. There's a lot of spreadsheets and things you can look through to see that we're making that progress. In terms of oversight with grants, Bowser, for example, is the biggest grantor of dollars, usually to local governments, and they have a grants management unit, and they regularly monitor how the grants are being used. We also, Bowser also does I don't know if it's Clean Water funded, but I call it a stress test. They have another good name for it, where they actually do a little mini audit of sorts with local units of government. They use their dollars, including the Clean Water Fund, to make sure that their systems are where they should be for financial management and governance. And they randomly pick a couple of watersheds to do that every year. But I can definitely pull some information together if you like.
Representative Hiltzley?
Just a quick clarification on that. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to know, we know that you're doing the work. We know that the council is doing the work. The question is, how can we support that work?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hiltzley, I suppose the easiest thing would be to support our recommendations. That would be an easy cop-out for me to say. But, we welcome the dialogue from the Capitol on how we're doing our work. And we get tough questions from people saying, what are you doing? How are you accounting for everything? Why are you spending money when industry should do this? I mean, we have all those interlocutors regularly from both sides of the aisle, which we welcome. I would like to pass along your question, though, to the council for its next meeting as we start doing some strategic thinking so that we actually can catalog all the areas where we're showing that transparency. But the recommendations are all laid out in your handout, and there will be the funding part will all be in a bill form very soon. 35 co-authors, I think, is the maximum.
Correct.
House, so love that.
Very good. We have just a few more questions. Mr. Gardner, we thank you for your expertise, but you're not done yet. My father's definition of an expert was a X marks the spot, and a drip is a spurt is a drip under pressure. So put that in your pocket. Yes. We have a very good question coming from Representative Scrabba. Yeah, that's the pressure.
I
better be good.
I thought this was your guys' show. Come on.
No, they.
No, mine. Just a couple of comments and a short question. One, I want to thank the legacy for putting extra money last year in the low-income household septic system. I think it's important, at least in my district, we have a lot of people that have second homes, and they can't afford to do one or the other, and they want to keep it. And if we can go in and help them fix their septic, I'm all for that. I mean, that's the easiest solution to a lot of the problems. And I think it's identified well in this program. So any way we can keep doing that, I support it wholeheartedly. One of the things you spoke about, Mr. Gardner, is the Lake Superior Basin for Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Do you remember which districts they were? Was it the, because I'm working with the north, you know, I have 175 miles of lakeshore and Lake Superior and that I represent, and those folks constantly, you know, looking for this stream and that stream, and they're all worthy projects, good projects, you know, but they tie into a road replacement, they tie into all these little things. And one of the things I like about Bowser's and these sort of districts is, you are correct, they actually are the boots on the ground. These are the folks that actually walk in the creek and put up the stuff to keep the impediments from going in the creek. So I'm just curious which ones you were talking, because it has MPCA after. Are these more in Duluth area or are they the shore?
Mr. Gardner.
Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Scrabba, I'll try and do this without having to punt to the PCA, but any of the water, Soil and Water Conservation Districts in the Lake Superior Basin, the drains in Lake Superior, I think are eligible. So that's Lake Cook, St. Louis, and Carlton, I think. Is that? Sounds right. Lake Cook, St. Louis, and Carlton for Lake Superior Basin. Yeah, we could certainly double check, but the idea was to make the most of any federal money we have from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, from the Lake Wide Area Management Program, LAMP.
Representative Scrabba.
And I think that's it. I think this program is it's for the most part, everything I've seen in the 2 years I've been here, it works, and, you know, I look forward to working with it in the future, too. So thank you.
Thank you. I should have said Vice Chair, Representative Scrabba. He's our Vice Chair. When I am not able to be here or goes afoul, you have to take the realm here. So,
presenting a bill, maybe.
Pardon, Representative Heisman?
When you're presenting a bill, maybe.
Oh, yes, that's why they do this. Yes. Mr. Gardner, I do have a question. Now, you stated in your comments or your program the percentage of money that goes to actual clean water initiatives. I think clean drinking water was the nomenclature. And I wrote it down, but could you restate what percentage goes to clean drinking water initiatives?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The constitutional language says that at least 5% must be spent on protecting drinking water sources. We did try to do some math on this, and we know that we're exceeding that number, that 5% number, easily. But then it gets a little fuzzy because there are some projects that support drinking water sources, but they're meant as a water quality thing for surface water, but they have the added benefit of protecting a drinking water source. And so I used a wide-ranging estimate, including all of those, where I got to close to 20% of the fund being spent that way, and I was urged to have a more conservative estimate where the direct reason was protecting a drinking water source, and that brings down the number to a lower number, but it's well above 5%. I mean, it's still double digits, so.
Thank you.
There's interconnections between groundwater and surface water. That's one of the main reasons. You can protect groundwater, and that will help surface water, and vice versa.
Very good. Yeah, the 5% seemed awfully low. I'm glad to hear that it is. That's just the number statutorily, but it is higher, because when this was sold back in 2007 or 6 and 7 when they fought this or, you know, communicated this and marketed it, it was all about clean water, if I recall, and clean drinking water as well. So it is above 5%.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Let me use this example. We do things to help improve water quality in the upper Mississippi headwaters, which have a direct benefit for that watershed. And it has a little bit of benefit, say, for St. Cloud and Minneapolis and St. Paul, but it would be hard to measure it. Is that protecting drinking water? Yes, but it's not the primary reason. So that's where we just really started to get twisted up in knots, trying to come up with an exact number.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? If not, Mr. Gardner, thank you very much. If I recall, Representative Scrubba, Vice Chair Scrubba.
Thank you. One thing I did want to correct is when I spoke about the extra money for the septic, you know, the families, a lot of families have multiple members on these cabins, and collectively they can hardly make it work. And they're not wealthy by any means. They just want to keep their homesteads, their family traditions, and everything has gone so high that we do help them. And it's not a rich person's game here. It's actually the things I'm trying to protect are the folks that want to be part of that but really can't afford to. And I see it almost every year. I see it happen. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scrabble. We'll let the court reporter duly noted.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gardner.
I just want to express my thanks for the generous amount of time that you have given us at the council. As things get closer to the end, one never has time, and I just appreciate the chance to do a deeper dive.
Very good. Thank you. And if I recall, you served from 2007 to 2011. You beat Phil Krinke by, what, 51 votes? Is that correct, Mr. Gardner?
In 2006, it was 51 votes, yes.
Yes, congratulations. And then my good friend...
Landslide Gardner was my name.
Yeah, Landslide Gardner, yeah. Yeah, and Phil Krinke was a force to be reckoned with. And then my good friend Linda Runbeck beat you.
That's correct.
And I came in 2011, so we didn't serve there. But thank you for service to the state. Lastly, just to point out something I mentioned at our first meeting, you folks weren't there, unfortunately, when we had our first meeting, but Mr. Brad Hagemeyer said something that was very important, and I mentioned that at the first meeting. His favorite part of Legacy was zero-based budgeting. We have an opportunity here, the Legacy Committee, and has been for quite some time, of doing what I think is good governance, starting at zero. If all of our state agencies did that, we would have probably surpluses going forward to eternity almost. That is very good governance by starting at a zero based and building. And Brad, or Mr. Hagemeyer, thank you for stating that that's the most important part, because it really is for funding. And that's all about funding for this organization. Members, we will uphold and protect the organizations and the four entities that bring their suggestions to us, and with respect. But at the end of the day, we all have our own districts and represent constituents. So certainly when you have very important projects that meet those four silos in Legacy, bring those to a bill, a green jacketed, because we do want to see and hear. The councils do a great job, but we too have some great important programs and initiatives in our district. So feel free and to get your bills jacketed and bring them to the committee so we can add those to the Legacy bill at the end of the session. If there's no other business before this committee, I want to thank the outsiders who are sitting on the stands on the outsides. You folks are doing important work, and we meet with you often as well. Feel free to contact any one of us with your important issues. If there's no other business, this meeting is adjourned.